Hi, everybody. Just before we start this week's show, we have a little announcement.
Yes, we do. I'm announcing that, Andy, you need to just close your ears for a quick moment. I just need to mention something privately to the listeners.
Okay.
Obviously, I don't want Andy to hear this, but I'm reading a new book at the moment called Bad Deeds by one Andrew Hunter Murray. And it is so annoying because it's kept me up extremely late every night for the last 7 days. It's so gripping. It's his new novel. It's a sequel to the last one that many of you might have read, Breaking and Entering. Doesn't matter if you haven't read it. It's also a brilliant standalone book. And it's an absolute page-turner, thrilling stuff, obviously with a lot of the trademark Andrew Hunter Murray wit. I feel like I was watching an action film for parts of it. It's amazing. Get it now, and now pretend I never said anything. Andy, you can open your ears again.
Hello.
Hi, I was just having a private chat, but you've got a book out.
Yes, it's called Bad Deeds. It's out today. We're recording this on the day of publication. It's a thriller set between London's dodgy property market and the wilds of rural Scotland. There's all sorts of skullduggery and mayhem and bad deeds. And the only other thing I'll say is, if you're an audiobook sort of person, you might like to know that the person who reads the audiobook is friend of the parish and former guest on this show. It's Phil Dunster. And he does an absolutely terrific job. So if you like audiobooks, maybe give that a go.
And where can people buy it? Grocery stores or...?
Well, I would say your local independent bookshop, but I will accept any sale is terrific. Thank you very much. So whether you're buying it offline or on. But no, do pop down to your local bookshop and ask them for like 10 to 12 copies is a good start.
There you go. 10 to 12 copies of Bad Deeds. Seriously, do it now. You will not regret it. Okay, on with the show.
On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with Anna Tashinsky, Andrew Hunter Murray, and James Harkin. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that in 17th century Sweden, Sami shamans had to work in secret. Unfortunately, most of their work involved constant drumming.
Sami shamans sounds like an end of the pier kind of magician.
Yeah.
Slash psychic.
That's true. Hi, it's Sami shamans. And here is my magical drum, because they did have magical drums, the Sami. They are a group of people who live in Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Northern Russia. And they still live there today. But they started off as hunter-gatherers, went into reindeer herding, and they move around with the reindeer. But one of the most important people in the community was the shaman, who is known as a Noaidi. And the Noaidi would communicate between the worlds by using this drum. And he would kind of bang, bang, bang and get into such a rhythm that he would get into some kind of weird sort of trance. And I say he because it was always a he. And they felt like they could transform into other creatures, transform into the wind, all this kind of stuff. And they were persecuted by Christian missionaries. And the Christian missionaries just basically said, we're having that drum. And they took the drums off them.
Confiscated them,
destroyed most of them. There's not many of them left, but there is one in the British Museum, which is where I read about this whole story.
They are engraved or painted with pictures. And I think there's a way you can do divination, as in the Sami shaman would strike the drum with a hammer that is made of an engraved reindeer antler. Okay. Because reindeer is a very big deal.
Yeah.
And then that makes a little brass ring that you've got dance across the surface of the drum. And how far it goes or what it lands on tells you, or tells him, because it is always a him. Woke hasn't yet come for the Sami shaman world, basically. And that tells you the future, you know.
Or I did read an account from 1674, which I think is the earliest account we have of more southern people, by a guy called John Sheffer, who said they also sometimes use the drums to decide what animal to sacrifice to their gods. So he said each drum would be covered in lots of pictures of animals and birds and fish and stuff. And then there was a kind of a pole attached to the drums, and at the top of it, a little brass frog, and you bang the drum, and when the brass frog fell off, whatever animal it landed on, whatever animal the frog chose, was the one that you had to kill. Great.
It's like a Wheel of Fortune kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
You're not proposing taking this ancient sacred ritual and putting it on ITV or primetime.
I'm afraid I am. Well, yeah. Which of these celebrities will we sacrifice? These images that you said, Andy, the Sami sort of would, once they started getting persecuted by the missionaries, they would like say, oh, this isn't a reindeer, this is a cross. And they would slightly sort of change all the drawings to make them more Christian in the hope that they wouldn't get taken. But they did all pretty much all get taken. There's not that many of them left.
I haven't heard much of the Sami, but I realize a kind of classic fact is to do with the Sami, which is the word poronkusema, which is the distance a reindeer can travel before it needs to stop and urinate. That's kind of a classic thing that you see online. Susie Dent tweets about that word quite often.
But as a reindeer ages, that distance will shrink. You know.
Yes.
Yeah. Many of your middle-aged male reindeer will stop just in case. Just it's nice to have stop when you can.
Also, like, your reindeer will walk for a long time, and then once they break the seal, then that's going to be a much...
Exactly.
And when I say breaking the seal, I don't mean like with a club or anything. The missionaries really didn't like the way the Siberians used their own urine to guide the reindeer, because what they would do is they would urinate into a seal skin, carry it around with them. And then if the reindeer wandered off, you would pour a bit of your urine on the floor, and then the reindeer would come back because they like the salt and the minerals and stuff like that. And so, yeah, the fact that they were doing this urine-y stuff, the missionaries were like, that's not really in our book.
What? I mean, where does the Bible say don't piss into a bag and then spill it on the floor when your reindeer runs away? I don't think
it's
says
in Leviticus.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
The one I haven't read.
All sorts of stuff. So the reindeer do eat the yellows, no?
Yeah, they do. They like to lick the... As do a lot of animals, really.
Yeah.
It'd be a good way to attract the old man in the coat. Have you heard of him?
No.
I mean...
Is it you?
It sounds like Dan with his creepy coat.
Yeah. Pushing my new business.
Your business?
Do you need a kid's birthday party? Absolutely ruined. Well, you need the old man in the coat.
All you need to do is piss out the front of your house and I'll come and lick it.
Isn't that what they know you as in Hampstead Heath?
Yes. The old man in the coat. It's what they call polar bears, the Sami.
Right.
Or God's dog is the other name.
It's a taboo.
It's a taboo. They don't want to give it its real name. God's so it's got a code name.
God's dog is very good.
God's dog is wonderful, yeah.
There's definitely a belief that that polar bears can speak English, but not very well, kind of as well as a toddler. So the belief is that they don't understand metaphors. So when you're talking about how you're going to hunt a bear, that's why you have to use metaphors like the fur-clad one.
Do you also say, oh, it looks like over there they're selling I-C-E-C-R-E-A-S?
I was reading just another thing on how the Christian missionaries dealt with them. In this early account from 1674, John Sheffer, he was Christian, so he had lots of comments about the Sami and how they weren't very good at being Christians. And he said, they stick at several points of Christianity, namely the resurrection of the dead and the immortality of the soul. And I just like that immediately afterwards he said, and they worship the sun chiefly for its light and its heat, believing all things are made by its means.
Oh, idiots.
Such a brilliant tone of patronizing disdain. I don't know why they can't get the whole resurrection of the dead thing. Also, they think the sun's really important.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So Linnaeus was a big fan of the Sami. Linnaeus, the guy who named all the animals, basically.
Yeah.
He used to say God creates and Linnaeus puts into categories. But he went to visit them and they had a big effect on him. So after that, he decided to just walk around in Sami clothing all the time.
Even when he was back home?
Yeah.
Really? He loved it, didn't he?
It obviously was a different time. But if I have just been to China and then I come back dressed like a Chinese person,
yes,
it's not going to work, is it?
I think, to be fair, he basically thought this whole reindeer coats works and wore a lot of reindeer head to toe, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he did carry the drum, which, to be fair, would seem a bit appropriatory.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think we all know somebody who's had a gap year and got a bit too into it.
Yeah.
Why are you looking at me like that?
I
never had a gap year. I just have a gap 2 weeks every year.
You're the guy dressed in a kimono today, Andrew. Okay.
And Dan, by the way, that Papua New Guinea gourd that you're wearing.
Thank you.
I know it's hidden by that big coat. But yeah, Linnaeus, one thing that he really liked about them is that the men would carry around a sweet-smelling fungus to attract women. just in the same way that I might spray Lynx Africa on myself. They would do this with a fungus. And he said, in other parts of the world, you must be wooed with coffee and chocolate, preserves and sweets, wines and dainties, jewels and pearls. Here, you are satisfied with a little withered fungus.
Well, it is very cold. Just a thing about drumming and drums, as we're on the Sammy and their drums, I found this absolutely wild. Mm. Drums are many thousands of years old, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we found ancient drums from civilizations all over the world. Mm-hmm. But the drum kit wasn't invented until the 20th century.
You know, are you telling me no one had ever thought of, like, I can use my other hand for this as well?
When are the first drum solos that you can think of? They're all quite recent.
Because I just think maybe people did them and didn't manage to record them onto cassette tape back in the day.
maybe.
It's interesting.
It's wild, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
I think the jury's out on that one, yeah. I would say.
That's crazy.
You can speak in drum if you're a certain type of person.
Oh, yeah.
From a certain type of place with a certain type of language. In West Africa, drum languages were quite common, probably less so now. But this is in languages specifically, which they're very tonal. So you can make a drum that can play lots of different tones. And so I think the Bulu dialect of the Bantu language is a very good example of this, where they'd have a drum where if you bang it at a different place along it, it makes a different tone. Mm-hmm. And therefore you can transmit messages up to 20 miles, apparently. And everyone would have a drum name. So you'd give someone their drum name. You'd bang on the drum their drum name. So, you know, they're boom, talking boom, to boom, you. Boom,
but it's like having a special knock on the door. Like, I always knock on the door the same, like...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a lot of people would do a similar thing. But if you heard that knock, there's a good chance it's going to be...
That's really interesting. And if you don't hear a knock at all, that's Dan in a big coat outside the front.
But you're then knocking to yourself. If I were a Bantu person, I'd use that knock for you then. That would be my way of saying, oi, James.
It? If we were on University Challenge, I would buzz in and they go... And they'd know it was me to answer then.
Yes, exactly.
Right, Harkin fish. Why have we never done University Challenge as a team?
We've just never been asked, Andy. And also, they don't do podcast teams.
We're not
they
a university.
University teams.
Yeah, but what the hell?
I mean, and we'd be very bad.
There's a broader truth that I think we're all missing, which is that it would be so much fun for
and
us.
Our insistence on being addressed by our drum names, I think, is also...
Podcast challenge, on the other hand, seems like a good idea.
Edit this out of the podcast. We're going to do Podiversity Challenge. University Pod Challenge. Right. We're going to do it.
We'll think of a name.
Yeah.
Don't edit this out. I don't want to do that. Keep it in so someone else steals the idea.
One thing I read about these drumming languages in Africa is you drum a phrase or a song or something that everyone knows what it means and everyone knows the context of it rather than just doing individual words.
Yeah, I read that as well. Yeah. And it's very weird because it already seems difficult to convey stuff via drum rather than words. And the fact that they've overcomplicated it by then saying you can use these metaphorical phrases, but it
like,
does seem to
for
work.
For instance, like, let's say I wanted a cake. I could go da-da-da-da-da-da and you would know, like...
Maybe right. It is simpler. Okay.
Or you'd be like, Badooch. Oh, the local comics here. Like that would be a good drum name for a local comedian.
True.
Here comes Sammy Shaman.
One of my close friends is a drummer professionally. One of the big things about drummers is that they have a bad reputation.
Yeah.
Not a bad reputation, but just a reputation maybe for being not
stupid.
Not the brightest member of the band.
I'm not saying they are. I'm saying that's what their reputation is.
Right.
And well, besides, they won't be listening to this podcast. It's way too highbrow.
So I asked him for some drummer jokes.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought you might like some of them.
Yeah, go on then.
What do you call someone who hangs around musicians?
A drummer.
A drummer. How can you tell if the stage is level? The drummer is dribbling out of both sides of his mouth. How do you know when there's a drummer at the door?
I don't know.
The knot gets faster and they don't know when to come in. What's the difference between a drummer and a savings bond?
I don't know.
One of them will mature and make money.
Wow. I think what this needs is a badumtish. Yeah. Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everyone. We'd like to let you know that this week we are sponsored by Bubble.
Yeah, Babbel. You know Babbel. We all use Babbel. We're learning languages. We want to find out the best way to get the most up-to-date vocabulary using the best tools available to get that stuff in our brains. Babbel's worked it out for you.
Absolutely. They let you practice real-life conversation step-by-step with no stress. And it just gives you confidence. Like, I've been learning my language of choice, which is Russian, for many, many years. But just doing Babbel, it just really helps you get up-to-date. If you've not done it for a little while, you go into Babbel, you do it for a little while, and suddenly you're an expert again.
Exactly. And it's not like the old school day of just buying a book and having to deal with it that way. They've worked out many different ways in which you can consume all of these language learning exercises. There's podcasts, there's interactive dialogues, and it's all curated by more than 200 language experts worldwide. So this really is the place to learn your language.
Yeah, don't buy a book like a big old nerd. Go to Babbel. And here is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get 60% off your Babbel subscription at Babbel.com/fish. That's Babbel.com/fish.
60%. No book's going to give you 60% off its sale price, is it? So do exactly what James says. Babbel.com/fish, and you'll get 60% off. Rules and restrictions may apply.
And there are some quite good books out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly The Theory of Everything Else.
Anyway, on with the podcast.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Andy.
My fact is, from 1990 to 2018, there was an award given out every year for the most human human.
You sounded so robotic. When you said
that. This was a prize that was given out. It was a subsection of a bigger prize, right? And it's all to do with the Turing test. So for anyone who hasn't heard of that before, that's the idea that Alan Turing, a brilliant computer scientist, proposed in the 50s that the way you would be able to tell when we had artificial intelligence is if a human is conversing with someone who's unseen and they are unable to tell whether they're talking to a person or a computer, that's when we'll have true artificial intelligence.
Yeah, which I would say is now, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, people are falling in love with AIs left, right, and center. Yeah. Like, we've way passed the Turing test. So by that metric,
certainly when we started this podcast, it wasn't true.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's the idea of the Turing test. And there was an annual prize during those years, starting in 1990, called the Loebner Prize, where people would bring along their own chatbots and they would be training them and improving them every year. And if your chatbot managed to fool a human judge, you would win a prize. There would be several thousand dollars for the most human computer. But as part of that, you obviously had to have some humans being on behind the screen chatting back for the judges to have any sense of, like, are you talking to a computer or a human? Sometimes you'd be talking to one, sometimes the other. And as a separate prize, the judges would pick the human chatter who was most convincingly human and give them $100 or some small prize.
I think this is a problem with the experiment, because if the human is then changing their attitude and the way that they respond because they're trying to get a prize,
yeah,
then that changes the experiment, right?
Well, and that is what happened, right? Brian Christian, who won the Most Human Human Prize, he wrote a whole book about it, and part of the book was telling how he prepared to be human as part of the test. And so he did study to be human to win it.
That feels like it's kind of cheating. Isn't the whole point that you've got to be yourself?
Revising for an exam is not cheating. And if the exam is, are you a human? It's completely reasonable
but
to prep.
We're testing the computers, right?
Yeah.
If the whole point of the exam is to test the marking system and you change your answers to make them completely wrong or completely right, then that's not a very good way of testing the marking system.
I think he was just practicing being himself and being authentic in conversation and being truly human.
How would you do it?
I prep several hours a day for all of my conversations.
You use the same person as Keir Starmer, don't you, for this?
If you wanted to pretend to be human, what would you do? Because I feel like you would just do something really dumb, right?
Yeah,
that's a great question, James. I'm so glad you asked me. But what do you think?
Here's the issue, though. If you've got very specific loves and so on as a person, and you bring them to the exam, you might lose. So one person was outed as a robot when they were a human because they knew far too much about Shakespeare. They said no human could possibly know this much about Shakespeare. It just so happens it was a Shakespeare expert on the other side who was a human.
Really, the way to do it now, and this is my optimistic theory about where the world
world's going, the only way to convince people you're human is to actually see them, because the only place that robots haven't managed to achieve anything like human resemblance is in the physical world, right? They still can barely move. I mean, I know there's all sorts of claims every year when they play football and they fold laundry and whatever, but if you watch them trying to even run marathons, they still don't look very human.
But they just won the marathon.
I know, but they didn't look like humans when they did. So I would say...
Pop a big coat on that guy who ran the marathon. People will think Dan's achieved a record time.
I would
time.
Say if you put that robot, because it was all over the news when I was in China, it was the top story in the news that day. If you put that robot next to Phoebe from Friends running, you would not be able to distinguish the two of them.
It's a real slam on Phoebe. But this is a thing about robot technology, right? Is that they've managed to mimic our brains unbelievably well. But physically, actually, it turns out that it's very, very difficult still. Right. And so I think people are going to be driven off their computers back into the real world.
That's a nice optimistic idea. Yes.
Hopefully not by driverless cars. Because there's a situation in Atlanta earlier this year where 50 Waymo driverless taxis drove through the same area between 6 and 7 o'clock because someone had put a children at play sign in the road, which wasn't supposed to be there. And they would drive into the road and then they'd try and get out and then they'd see that sign and they'd go back in the other direction again and they'd just be driving in circles and circles and circles.
So, it kind of works, as in they can see a children at play sign and know that that's something they should...
But it's like you can kind of hack it to kind of make them drive around in circles and get lost because they're not thinking.
Can I tell you just a quick thing about this guy Loebner who set up the prize?
Yeah.
Because he was, I don't know if you read into him, he was very eccentric.
Yeah.
So it was treated like serious AI. People said this is just a stunt. You know, he gave out a medal with Alan Turing on one side and him on the other. You know, he was there was this amazing. He sadly died about 10 years ago now, but he was a very interesting cookie. So there was this piece about him in 2011. He had made his living in portable crowd control fencing and roll up disco dance floors. That was his main line of work.
Cool.
I know. Cool, right?
That is, yeah.
And he wanted to sponsor the prize because his idea was true artificial intelligence will free the world from work. You know, very optimistic that there won't be any work anymore. But his other speech after the competition was all about his plans to revolutionize public transport using roller coasters. He says a roller coaster is the ideal transport system. It could work and it would solve many of society's problems. Whether it can be implemented is another matter.
I agree.
What's a driverless car except a kind of slightly shit roller coaster?
What's a tube apart? What's the underground apart from a roller coaster?
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah, the key difference with a roller coaster is that you always end up where you started. So that feels like the tube is a bit better than a roller coaster.
Well, the circle line functions.
Imagine if, like, every time you came into work, you could buy a photo of yourself on the way to work. That would be great.
Worth it.
I interviewed Loebner. I met him.
Did you?
Yeah, it was online. I met him. I interviewed.
Are you sure it was him?
It could have very well have been a chatbot. But it was him who I interviewed alongside Mitsuku, who was the chatbot that had won the Loebner Prize, or got first place in the Loebner Prize 5 times, and is the final champion because it stopped in 2019, I think. Very eccentric character even to look at, you know, like a Dali-esque mustache, and he had two big passions. It was roller coasters, and it was making prostitution seen as something as a normal day-to-day thing that you would just go within your marriage and go, I'm just going to go to the brothel.
You must be this tall to go on this ride.
Yeah.
Don't take a photo of me halfway through.
I know we're focusing on the prostitution.
Get wet.
Scream if you want to go faster.
I know you want to carry on, Anna, but we've got a few more of these.
Oh, not good. I was sick twice and my hat fell off.
You must keep your arms inside at all times.
Just let them get it out of their systems.
Give it a minute.
Here's an interesting thing.
I shouldn't have had that hot dog just before.
Here's an interesting thing. We're talking about love and talking about AI. There was a guy called Robert Epstein. In 2006, he was looking online for love, and he found and fell in love with a Russian woman. They exchanged love letters and so on. And for about 4 months, it was going back and forth until he finally realized, hang on, is this a real person? And it wasn't. It was an AI bot.
He was an expert in the field of...
He is the co-founder of the Loebner Prize, Robert Epstein. This is a good 16 years after this prize had been set up. He fell in love with an AI bot online.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Basically, almost anyone's susceptible to it, I think.
Yeah. On telling the difference between humans and robots, how good are you at proving you're a human online with the recaptures.
Oh, you mean like which of these is a boat kind of thing?
Exactly. How many traffic lights in this?
Click the traffic lights.
You know what I think? I reckon I've got it wrong before and it's let me pass.
That's because robots are better at it.
Really?
Yeah. The constant problem they have is trying to get ahead of the AI because AI works out how to hack it over and over again. Mm. And basically, by 2014, 99% of bots could solve the distorted letter ones where they said, you know, type the letters you see. And in 2023, there was a study that found that bots are better than people at the picture ones by some degree. So when you're shown the image, 78% of the time, people got it right. 100% of the time, the bots got it right.
But I thought the point was that they're getting you to do this, but while you're doing it, they're checking your browser history to make sure you've not been going on the same website 500,000 times.
Usually,
oh, really?
The reason.
Well, that's what I thought it was, but
sometimes, usually, the reason you get a capture is because your browser history isn't human enough. So the only way to get around it now, really, is to allow cookies, browse the internet for 5 minutes, and then go onto the website that you want to go on, because then they see that you've browsed the internet like someone. Because it used to be that they could tell if you were too slow clicking the mouse, you're a human.
I'd like deliberately wobble my mouse a little bit so it looks more human.
None of that works anymore. The robots have learned to act like an idiot, like a human.
I thought we were just training it. I mean, I know that that was the idea. The idea was we were teaching the AI what traffic lights look like in every single...
We are as well.
So that's still happening? We're still training them? Right, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Is this sometimes why when I get to the end of page 18 on a Google search for moth, let's say, it says, come on, are you a human? Do you ever get that? You get to the end of...
Oh, really?
Because nobody clicks through 18 pages of Moth results.
I think that will be why, yes.
Remember there was the big thing where Watson, the IBM AI computer, went on Jeopardy, and there was a whole thing about Jeopardy. There was a big complaint from the makers of Watson who said they rewrote the questions so that it didn't allow for it to do it. So, for example, an example given is, in 2002, Eminem signed this rapper to a 7-figure deal, obviously worth a lot more than his name implies.
50 Cent.
50 Cent.
What's his 50 Cent? Damn it!
And Watson would be able to figure that out, but they rewrote it to lose 2002 and Eminem in there. So it relied on you to make a connection of a pun.
I see.
From the second half of
But surely the quiz question is basically, do you know that 50 Cent is one of Eminem's stable of rappers? Isn't it?
I think any musician with money in their name, like a low denomination in their name. Because I didn't know that about the stable of rappers, but I did know that 50 Cent is
Yeah, the thing is with like those questions is they give you two different ways of getting to the answer, right?
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Either with the pun or with the knowledge.
Yeah, and that's why they complained. But it's interesting. I put it into ChatGPT this morning just to see what it would give if I gave the question without 2002 and Eminem. And it, you know, of course, immediately came up. Probably 50 Cent, a 7-figure deal is worth far more than 50 cents, was its logical answer.
Yeah, so it can do that now.
Oh, so it over-explains the jokes?
Yes.
Oh, dear. Maybe I, too, have an AI.
I gave AI a lateral thinking puzzle, and it couldn't crack it. So that was satisfying. This was triggered by the fact that I was wondering if Roald Dahl was a vegetarian because I just read a book of his that was very anti-hunting. So I said, is Roald Dahl a vegetarian? Right. And Google AI said, there are many clues in his books to suggest he's a vegetarian. For instance, Fantastic Mr. Fox is vegetarian. And obviously I thought, well, the whole plot of Fantastic Mr. Fox is about him eating meat. So I don't think he is.
There's a bit where he breaks into a barn and just kills two chickens instantly.
He's like, I'm a flexitarian chicken, basically. It's not real meat, is it? Like, obviously, the carbon footprint of chicken is a lot better than beef.
So I thought, that's faulty. So I tried Claude, the Anthropic AI, on this riddle, which I always just love. So it's, and you have to write it down, but imagine you have 1, 3, and 5 in a row, and then directly beneath it, write 2, 4.
The words.
No, the new numbers has to be numerical, 2 and 4. And then a question mark directly beneath the 5.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's the question mark?
6.
So you think it's 6. So obviously that's what AI says to me first. And but you can see Claude tells you it's working. So it's like, it says, sussing out lateral thinking options. No, is it 6? And you say, no, it's not 6.
I think it's 5 again.
I gave it so many clues. Still didn't get it. I'll give you guys a clue.
Yeah.
It's not a number and it's related to cars. And this is kind of an example of something that AI can't do.
It's an R for reverse.
It's an R.
Oh, come on.
And that's because robots don't drive cars.
But I don't. They don't drive manuals.
In fairness, I think 6 is a legitimate answer to that question.
Completely, but it's when you tell it, it's not 6. It couldn't. And the thing about AI is it's overconfident. So at one point it said, I've got it. It's F.
Right.
You know when AI is really, I've done it now.
Sorry, AI is overconfident. Maybe I too am an AI.
Isn't dal a vegetarian curry?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so roll dal, if not a vegetarian, at least.
Why?
Is a vegetarian curry. Yeah.
Very good.
And AI can't make proper jokes. Maybe you too, Dan, are an AI.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that the only ride at France's second most popular theme park is a €2 carousel. Yeah.
Well, I've just taken my daughter to Disneyland in Shanghai. 10-hour flight, however much money it costs, trains, all that stuff, and all she wanted to do was go on the carousel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We went on the carousel 4 times.
Right, now back on the plane.
So this sounds perfect.
Yeah.
There you go. Would have been a slightly cheaper carousel than the one you went to. Well done. And that's all it is. No,
so
this
why is this such a shit theme park?
It's Puy de Fou, and it's the second best after Disneyland Paris, obviously, which trumps everything. But this is a theme park that was set up in the 1970s. It gets over 3 million visitors a year. It's the 8th most popular in Europe, and it's basically a place where they do historical reenactments. Mm. And it began in the 70s when this guy, Philippe de Villiers, who I'm sure we'll come on to talk about, found a ruined castle, as you do stumble upon a lot in France. And he thought, I'm going to stage a reenactment of this thing called the Vendée Rebellion, which was a counter-revolutionary rebellion round about the French, well, at the time of the French Revolution.
Yeah.
So he staged a reenactment. It got bigger and bigger. And now it's 60 shows that act out historical events from all across history and all across geography. It's got these 4 period villages. So when you stay there, you stay in a period village.
It sounds amazing.
It sounds absolutely incredible. I'm desperate to go.
I went to stay somewhere recently that didn't have any of this, but it was faintly medievally themed.
Oh, yeah.
And the restaurants were things like the Knights Tavern.
And that whet your appetite, did it?
Yeah, what are you saying?
I'm saying I could see myself.
This sounds better, is what you're saying.
I'm saying this sounds better, yeah. Right.
Even than Tavern.
I think there is plenty available for people like you in the UK right now if you want to get involved in the medieval scene.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of reenactments going on.
Really?
Definitely. I'll put you in touch with some people.
Thank you.
But none of them are this level, though. And this, I suppose, is less like you reenact it as you watch other people. So there's shows that are put on.
You're just watching. Yeah. Did anyone else watch an hour-long YouTube video of someone going from each of the reenactments?
No.
Okay, I did. And to begin with, it's...
I like the way you're reenacting the reenactments by watching them on YouTube.
Yes, yeah. I thought you would get a bit fatigued with the amount of reenactment that you're watching if you decided...
Come on.
Yeah, I think it loses... About 35 minutes in, I sort of regretted my decision to watch the full hour.
But that's what the carousel is for.
Yes.
It's like a palate cleanser.
Yes.
Surely live it's more exciting and, you know, you're caught up in the sweep of French history.
Kind of.
Okay.
I think
you're
so.
Quite far away, so it's sort of like watching a very like well-produced panto at a distance. I mean, it's epic.
Three million people a year can't be wrong, Dan.
Well, have you read the TripAdvisor reviews?
They're very strong. They're very strong. Okay. Yeah.
They're going to build one in the UK.
They are.
Apparently,
Oxfordshire. Yeah.
Bicester.
In Bicester. And we're going to have three hotels, each themed around different periods in British history. Just wondering if you had any favourites.
Ooh.
I was thinking COVID era.
Yeah.
No toilet paper.
Yeah. Also, General Strike.
General Strike.
That'll be one of my favorites.
Just 3 days for the price of 5.
Lovely.
yeah.
I mean, there'll be a Tudor one, won't there? Because it's British, it's English history.
Yeah.
British history. So
weird that people are obsessed with the Tudors when the revolution happened the next century. And it's Argo Revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone shaved their heads.
Which revolution? Do you mean the
Civil
War?
Civil War. Yeah. So half of the people shave their heads.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. If it's everyone, there's no war, is there? Everyone just agreeing all the time.
Swinging 60s, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I think that'd be a cool one.
Okay. I bet they would do that, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Like have a little Soho vibe.
I would say, outrageously, the French one, Puy de Fou, has the King Arthur stuff. I have no idea how they've managed to swing getting the rights to King Arthur.
Very litigious.
The estate must be trading, surely. I just think,
Is there an estate? for King Arthur.
No, I'm joking.
It feels like there could be.
Who's an AI now? I can't tell.
I think like there was quite a bit of Frenchy stuff going on in those Arthurian tales,
yeah.
Aren't there?
Yeah. It's all the Mort d'Arthur is written half in French and all of this. Yeah. The Norman. Okay, yeah.
Right. And it's famously ahistorical, this place, to be fair. The makers tend to say we're just trying to entertain.
But are they trying to entertain?
Well, there's the big question. It's quite controversial.
Are they trying to sneak in right-wing propaganda to families? Because that's what some people say.
It's what some people claim. And the fact that it was founded by quite an extreme right-wing politician is neither here nor there, I don't think.
Well, he's not there anymore because it's run by another guy, his son, I think, called Nikola, who described Vladimir Putin as having sweet eyes and sweet words.
Oh, cool.
I saw, by coincidence, because we've been planning to do this for a week or two, there was an article in Harper's Magazine this week where author Nat Segnit went to this place. And he said it was a bit like hanging out with an exceptionally charismatic and entertaining friend whose opinions only strike you as objectionable in retrospect.
That's very funny. Yeah. So what is the idea? Is it that it's presenting a particular slant on history?
It's very pro-Catholic, it's very pro-French monarchy, it's very sort of like looking back at the past and wasn't France great in the past and shouldn't we go back to France being great again?
Kind of. It's very into old school France.
Right.
But fun. And that's how the right wing get you. Yeah. They make it fun.
The craziest thing about this theme park, in my opinion, is when you get there, you get a little booklet, you know, the free booklet that tells you the map of everywhere that you're going to go. And it's in multiple languages. And at the top of each one of them has the date of the day that you're going on, which means they print them every single day for the day that you're visiting the theme park.
To you, that's the craziest thing about this insane place, which has deep, weird, like, political...
How much ink are we... are we wasting here? How many trees have been chopped down so that we can go?
Yeah, but they probably are quite good at knowing how many people have booked in for that day, so they just know how many to press on the printer. That for you is the weirdest thing.
That's the weirdest thing.
Also, they can print all of them and then just print the date separately.
I think it's like an additional stamp as well.
That could be a little man in a booth who just stamps on the date.
It looks very printed on.
I don't think it's that. I think, Dan, this implies you think whenever you scrunch up a brochure and throw it away, you think someone's going around all the bins, taking them all out, ironing them and reusing them the next.
No, I'm thinking they've got a big batch in the warehouse. They don't have to go, where's the guy with the printing for today?
We've got 10,000 people in today. How many guys should we print, do you think? Should we do about 10,000? Yes.
Well, let's print 10,000 every day.
Because, Dan, this is the amazing thing about time. They know which date is coming. So if today is the 9th,
what if it's
someone's there to go.
What if there's huge cancellations because it's raining too much or something? What if COVID happened and they've got suddenly 365 days worth?
For 2026, do they put 2026 or just 26? Because if it's just 26, they can reuse it in 100 years.
See? Okay, now we're talking. Okay, maybe it's not so weird.
By which time, the great French government will have risen and taken over the world again.
The Bourbon monarchy will be restored again. I mean, it's very interesting and strange. And I think the reason that it's not very well known about, certainly in the UK, is that 85% of the visitors are French. Mm. You know, loads of French people holiday within France. Yeah. And and obviously it's so about France that it's naturally appealing to the French people. So,
I think so. And I think there is one in Spain as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
So they've done one in Spain. They've done one in France. They're going to do one in the UK.
Yes.
I think it's...
Apparently the Spanish one is quite politically conservative on just how good a thing the colonization of the Americas was.
Oh, is it?
And it depicts the Europeans saying, well, we'll only go ahead and colonize if you guys really want us to, and as long as we're going to treat you really, really nicely. That's sort of written into the show. Yeah.
It's like the Weatherspoons of theme parks. They're all, you know, you get your cheap ruddles, but you've got a political agenda you've got to sift through when you're in there.
I can't believe we're talking about Weatherspoons again. I can't believe it. But the Weatherspoons often, they dish out magazines that have the proprietor's views in them, which is quite rare for a pub. You know, you don't normally get like a strongly angled magazine.
Yeah. Wasn't that your point?
Yeah.
I'm over-explaining. I just think people won't know that there's a Weatherspoons newspaper.
Sorry, got it, yes.
International listeners.
No, international listeners may not.
By now, everyone internationally knows about Weatherspoons. We're sorry to keep talking about it, but...
You know what they don't do? They don't stamp the date on every single newspaper because they're not nutcases.
Do you know who does? Newspaper stamp.
It's a weekly newspaper. It's not a daily newspaper.
Crazy.
I just quickly on the one...
in the UK, which should be fine because we don't have an awkward colonial history, so I doubt there'll be anything controversial in that. But it's planned for Bucknell, which is near Bicester, and there are obviously residents who are very against it and residents who are very pro it, and I just like the fact that it is in Oxfordshire and the residents are led on the pro side by a woman called Caroline Chipperfield Twiddy and on the anti side by Flo Van Diemen Van Thor, which shows how really Oxfordshire
speak for England flow
gets.
That's very interesting.
That's very funny.
On reenactments in 2014, there was a World War II reenactment that we were going to do in Barnsley in Yorkshire, but it had to get cancelled because people would be wearing Nazi insignia. And so the council stopped it, but said that they would be able to reschedule if they did a World War II reenactment with no Nazi elements whatsoever.
Mm. Right. That's very funny.
That's very good. I think reenactment's really interesting. Like, for example, Civil War reenactments, quite often that as they're sort of digging holes in the ground, they'll actually find the bones of a fallen soldier from the Civil War. This is in America.
Okay.
And that will then be brought back to a museum and so on. And so they're digging up artifacts as they are doing reenactments of
Why are they
Civil
digging
War.
Holes as part of Civil War reenactments? No. Was that a major? Was there a lot of tunneling in the
maybe,
Civil War?
I'm not sure. Some of them maybe just dig a hole, maybe to poo in. I don't know. You know, I don't know what the outdoor latrine situation is.
I am not using that portaloo. They did not have that in the Civil War.
Oh my God, I have a fact about portaloos in war reenactments. You know how in the American Civil War, and in fact in loads of wars, some women have donned men's clothes and they've gone into war. You know, that's a thing that happens. And some women in the American Civil War dressed as men and fought in battles, right? Yeah. In 1989, there was an American woman called Lauren Cook Burgess, and she had to fight a discrimination lawsuit because she had been banned from taking part in a US Civil War reenactment. She had dressed as a male soldier to try and sneak into the reenactment of the war, and then she was caught coming out of a women's loo and was told off and told to go and put a dress on because there were no female soldiers in the war. She said, yes, there were female soldiers dressed as men in the war. I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And she had to fight a 4-year court battle and won the case. She eventually won and was allowed officially to be
it
on
is
the
a
pitch.
Bit mad that they're saying you can only do it if it's really true to what happened in the past, but she is coming out of a portal.
I know.
Yes.
Exactly, yeah,
it's
I know.
Civil War reenactments are obviously a big deal, but there's one particularly moving one I read about, which was in 1913, an early one. This is in a Ken Burns documentary. And two armies restaged the Pickett's Charge, which was when Confederates tried to break through Union ranks. The Unionists descended on them and defeated them. Anyway, it was reenacted by veterans from the Civil War. And
what year?
1913.
So that's
50th anniversary. And they came, and it was an amazing moment. So they all knew how to do it. There was no arguments about accuracy.
So it was veterans from both sides?
Veterans from both sides. Wow. And the ones who were on the Union side were there waiting behind trees and stuff, ready to ambush. And the ones on the Confederate side charged through the fields and were descended upon. But as they descended, when they met, rather than killing each other, they all hugged each other and burst into tears.
Oh. Wow. Was it much of a charge? How old were these men?
It was a limp. Yeah,
50 years
charge.
Later, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't as fast as they had once been.
Yeah.
Gosh.
That's cool, though.
Amazing,
that's
though.
Really
that's very
cool.
Amazing moment.
Unless you were there on the sidelines to watch the reenactment, that would have sucked.
What just was...
What was this?
Come on.
Mushy shit.
You're not watching an hour of that, are you, on YouTube? Imagine 57 minutes into your YouTube video, you're like, finally, they're going to kill each other. Oh, what is this? This is woke gone mad.
The first 57 minutes is the charge.
Here this we go.
So good.
Okay, it's time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that John Williams, the composer of soundtracks like Jaws, Star Wars, and Indiana Jones, doesn't actually like film music.
Oh.
Doesn't like it. This is so probably funny. The finest, certainly the most decorated person in the world of Hollywood soundtracking, and he says, I never liked film music very much. He said, it can be good, but it usually isn't, other than maybe an 8-minute stretch here and there. I think that the music just isn't there, that what we think of as this precious gift film music is, we're remembering it in some kind of nostalgic way.
Well, he's like a proper composer of non-film music as well as film music, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
His main hobby from the day job of the film music is composing concertos and symphonies.
And I think he sees the film music as just a job, but the concertos is the main thing that he likes to do. That
he does see it as just a job, But he's very good at his job. He's had 54 Oscar nominations. That's more than any other living person.
Yeah,
I think he's only won 5, though. So that's a lot of losses, isn't it?
Not that good.
So the only other person who's had more is Walt Disney. Who had 59.
Right.
But like Walt Disney's, a lot of them were for cartoons. And they were all like, for instance, in 1938, he was nominated 4 times in the same best cartoon category. So like he boosted up his numbers basically by just being the only person who was making good cartoons.
Did they cut to like a shot, 4 different shots on the screen of Walt Disney from different angles? And when it's announced, 3 of them look really pissed off and one of them looks thrilled.
In that 1938, there were only 5 nominations for best cartoon and he got 4 of them. And the only one he didn't make was Paramount's Hunky and Spunky.
Right.
That's my favourite.
Yeah.
he is right, John Williams, isn't he? Like, it's always so annoying when Classic FM, if anyone who works there is listening, does Classic FM at the movies. Because the point is, film music is only good when you're watching the film because it's meant to be background to the thing that's happening. Mm-hmm. So
I'm not sure everyone agrees with you, Anna.
Really?
I disagree.
I will sometimes pop on the score of Mission Impossible
6. Can I just say, I agree with you, but I think a lot of our listeners might not. And listener, if you're hearing this and you don't agree with Anna, a lot of people are like you, you don't need to write in.
Andy, feel free.
It's a growing thing. Lots of concerts are put on of exclusively film music. And I mean, the ones John Williams has come up with, when you think of the theme tune of Jaws or Jurassic Park, they're so memorable and they're so easily called to mind.
Yeah. And people like music that they've heard lots of times. A lot of people do.
Yeah.
It's some kind of effect, isn't it? Like the exposure effect. The more you hear something, the more you like it. And so if people hear a lot of film themes a lot of times, they're going to like them.
Yeah. He doesn't even like films very much, John Williams. He says, "I was never a movie buff or movie fan, then as now."
Yeah, so he says he's never sat through any of the Star Wars films. At
sat
least not
through.
All the way through. But like, in fairness to him, he says, in the interview I read, he said he'd not watched them, but I'm not particularly proud of that, I have to say. So he's not like one of these people's like, oh, I'm just too smart to watch Star Wars.
I've never seen Star Wars.
Yeah, but like, because there are a lot of people like that, right? But he's like, well, you know, I feel a bit embarrassed that I haven't watched it, which I think is quite a nice stance.
Yeah, I think it's more common as well than we realize that directors and people who have to watch the footage so much, because he does compose to the footage, he's watched it probably more than anyone else, just not in the final package, right?
Yes.
He was a session musician, by the way, before he properly got into composing his own stuff. And there's one iconic song that I just didn't know he played a part in. He was the piano on the song Peter Gunn by Henry Mancini. Dun, 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 dun. That's him on the piano.
I don't know what that is, sorry.
No, neither do I, I'm afraid.
Even with your amazing rendition.
It's used as the theme tune or the kind of motif in the film The Blues Brothers. It crops up again and again and again in that. So that's
interesting. You know, well, maybe it's my singing of it, but it's used in a lot of adverts.
To be honest, it sounded like one of those drum names.
Yes. Yes, somewhere out there, a Sammy person just went, yes. Who said that?
His son, Joseph, is the lead singer in the band Toto.
Oh, cool.
Yes. Isn't
Although
that cool?
Not when they did the only song that Toto is known for.
That's
true. Oh, really?
He wasn't there when they released Africa, but he was the singing voice of Simba in The Lion King.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And he has also scored some films, like his father. So he scored Embrace the Vampire, The Legend of Gator Force, Soccer Dog, Real Estate Superman, and Fat Beach, which is considered one of the best hip-hop beach movies of all time, according to Wikipedia.
Yeah, yeah.
Dan's nodding.
Dan's thinking, why aren't we talking about this guy? Yeah. He's the real legend.
Finally, Real Estate Superman is getting some air on our podcast.
Real Estate Superman sounds just like one of Andy's ideas for a cop show. No, hear me out, guys.
He goes into a modest two-bedder with potential, and he comes out as Superman and spins around.
The first person to produce a record from a film score was someone called Anne Rennell with a film called Ladies in Retirement. And we have slightly come across her before, almost, because she wrote additional lyrics to the song Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf? But arguably the first female person who did a score of a movie was friend of the podcast.
Alice Guy.
A Guy?
A Guy, yeah.
No way.
So A Guy, she made some sound films, and hers were more like soundscapes than the music. But she would like, there's one that she did called Canned Harmony, where a guy comes in and tries to persuade the father of a girl that he wants to marry that he should be allowed to marry her. And he pretends to play the violin while someone underneath the table is actually playing the violin. And that was a guy who came up with
that's
that.
So good. Was that really early days?
Well, she was the first female director.
Yeah. Yes.
So that's like,
I think you talked about her last time I was away, but I remember, yeah, she was like almost the first director, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was.
She's come up on the podcast a few times.
Let's, if we're talking early film, there is a theory that goes that the reason soundtracks happened at all was to distract the audience from getting annoyed by the amazing amount of ruckus being caused by the projector. So it gave you something to focus your attention away and cover up that noise. It's a theory that other people say that no, it was...
It's also, you're trying to reflect what the world is like in a film.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the other theory,
I suppose. It's quite cool that original soundtracks were sheet music that was handed to the in-house musician who would just play the tune.
Would they have the date of the show?
Oh, God. I
hope not.
They tended not to play it, right? So it was always women. This is in the old Nickelodeons. Oh, yeah. And they'd be given sheet music and generally they ignored it and they would improvise. So you got to see the film and improvise along. So you didn't know what kind of a film you were getting. One day you might get a horror. The next day it might be a comedy. Because basically the genre of a film is almost dictated by the music, isn't it? If you put funny music over a horror film, it's no longer a horror film. Yeah. And the lady at the piano in the Nickelodeon could just
determine
that.
She's got the power. That's really cool.
All the power.
Yeah. I've got a fact about another very big soundtrack film guy. Vangelis. Big name within the world. He did Blade Runner, Chariots of Fire, stuff like that. His music's very sought out. Like, he's just loved as a musician. Did a lot of stuff separate to soundtracking. But there's one piece that he did, which was roughly 12 hours long, that fans have been trying to find because it's quite scarce. And it was when he did a straight-to-VHS thing. It was three VHSs that the music was spread over, called Micro Neurosurgery with Videotapes, Spinal Space Occupying Lesions by Dr. Sturgios Tegos, Medical Publications. And it was a friend of his who was a spinal surgeon who wanted to show all of his techniques. And so he got Vangelis to make a soundtrack.
Score it.
Yeah, because it's incredibly boring watching him just do it. That's what he figured.
Right.
And so this has only ever been released on these VHSs, but obviously it wasn't a big print run of the videos.
Yeah, yeah. But have you managed to buy one?
eBay is... I'm going to have to finish soon because the auction's about to end. And
that, like, that Chariots of Fire... theme tune, even as a skeptic of movie soundtracks, Anna, that is pretty, it's a top one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hold on, give it to me.
Yeah.
It starts with the dum dum dum.
So I think the problem, just to circle back around to the start, the problem with this is that everyone knows the little hook, right? So everyone knows the bit they like. And I agree, that was fun to hit, but the rest of the tune is often a bit crap background. And you have to listen to all of it when they do Classic FM at the music.
But all the great composers have probably there's one bit of the hour-long symphony that they think, I've really nailed that bit.
If you've ever been to the opera, everyone sits there through 4 hours of the fucking thing. Yeah. And then they get to the bit that goes... And then everyone in the crowd just sits up because they get to a bit that they recognise. Yeah. And then...
just leave after... da, 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 da. Go.
But this podcast is like that, Anna. It's an hour long. There'll be one bit where Dan's explaining something.
Okay. About his...
And you're saying that was the highlight.
I'm saying that that's what people are tuning in for. That's when they set up, you know.
Yeah.
Can I tell you one of my favourite scoring stories? Of all time? So we all know The Snowman.
Of course, yeah.
We're walking in the air.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Totally beloved in the UK. Yeah. I don't know if it's famous around the whole world, but it's a really iconic, beautiful story about a boy who makes a snowman. The snowman comes to life and they go walking in the air. They fly through the air.
Yeah.
It was scored by a guy called Howard Blake. And he came up with the idea because he had been seriously overworked, right? He was composing so much and working so hard. He went down to Cornwall and he lived for 3 months in a single hut with just a bed and a one-bar fire, living a really rustic, much slower pace of life.
Lovely.
And one of the last jobs he was offered before it, before he decided to do this, was a comedy called Percy about a man with a 14-inch penis. And he just thought, maybe I need a break from work.
Okay. Oh. Was Alan Jones also in that one?
I don't know.
I think that was written by Michael Palin and Terry Jones.
Was stunning.
It? I think.
Oh, wow.
Pulling from knowledge.
Python knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, amazing knowledge. Imagine. I mean, who knows that much about Python? You must be AI.
Ironically, massive Python. And he wrote it. He was walking along the beach when he thought of walking in the air, and he jotted it down on an envelope.
Really? Because not many snowmen in winter in Cornwall.
No. But I was thinking, you know, we talked a little while ago about the Bailey Bridge, that kind of bridge called the Bailey Bridge. It might have been on a Little Fish.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the guy who came up with that, it was an amazing prefab bridge that was incredible in the Second World War. He jotted his design down on the back of an envelope.
Oh, yeah.
So my pitch is, it's maybe a museum of all the envelopes. Oh, no, it's a book of the envelopes.
Right.
Right? Like all the things that have been drawn on an envelope. You get those envelopes together.
Specifically envelopes?
What about napkins? Like people have drawn on napkins, loads of things.
That's a rival museum.
Fag packets?
Yeah, I think it's got to be envelope. I think back of an envelope is the...
Because remember the Wellcome Institute, we saw the paper of which the first DNA sequence, the drawing of how that would look, the DNA strands, that was just on the back of a discarded bit of paper.
Yeah.
But not an envelope. So
that's not allowed.
Yeah, fair enough.
Why do you do this to yourself? Make it a little bit broader and it'll make it so much easier to write.
It just won't be the same book. Because the title is back of an envelope, you know.
Yeah.
And the gag is like,
call it back of a ... And then that kind of encapsulates them all.
I don't think it works.
Ah.
Because I came up with the idea for the book and then wrote it down on the back of an envelope. Right.
So you wrote it on your notes here. We saw you do it.
So anyway, that's.
What was the fact? I forgot now how we got here.
The guy, Howard Blake, who came up with the walking from the snowman, wrote it down on the back of an envelope.
Was he walking down to the post office to post the envelope?
I don't know.
Why is he walking with an envelope?
Yeah.
Like, that's weird.
Good question.
So many questions.
Good question. No one carries, even in the 80s, no one's just walking around with envelopes.
No, you might have a receipt in your pocket or like a bit of paper or something.
I think that's what's going to make my book so special.
Yes. The mystery of it all.
Yeah, what? Who's got these envelopes? Why is it always envelopes? What's going on?
But it never is. That's why you can't fill the book. That's the problem.
Well, that's a second order problem, I think. First order is meeting publishers.
I think there's a photo of you in every publishing house in London saying, do not let this man in.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on Schreiberland on Instagram. James?
No such thing as James Harkin on Instagram.
Andy?
At Andrew Hunter M.
And you can get to us as a group. Anna, how?
You can email podcast@qi.com or we're on @nosuchthingasafish on Instagram.
Yep, that's right. So, yeah, if you want to take part in one of our other shows, for example, Little Fish... podcast@qi.com, as Anna says, is the place to send your best facts that you found out. Or perhaps you have feedback about things that we've said, experiences related to the podcast. Do write into us because we will bring those emails to Drop Us a Line, which is our special bonus episode that sits within Club Fish, our private members club. And you can find out all about Club Fish by going to patreon.com/clubfish. Check it out now. Otherwise, just come back next week because we will be back with another episode and we'll see you then. Goodbye.